Okay, so this is going to be a presentation with Dr. Nikki Kolodny. It's going to be recorded just for Dr. Kolodny and my own records. Can I just get a general verbal consent to that, or if anyone doesn't want that, verbal for the record?
Yes!
Okay. Okay, so Dr. Nikki Kolodny was a pro-choice activist, abortion provider, and women's health advocate operating in Toronto, Ontario throughout the 1980s and 1990s. Dr. Kolodny became somewhat of a public figure in Canada when she worked alongside Dr. Henry Morgenthaler providing patients with abortions prior to 1988 when anti-choice legislation was struck from the Criminal Code. During this period, abortion clinics were frequently raided by the police, while abortion providers were harassed and sometimes even physically attacked by anti-choice activists. As a member of the Ontario Coalition for Abortion Clinics, Dr. Kolodny appeared frequently in the media to combat medical misinformation. So let's give a warm welcome to Dr.
This is a stroll down memory lane for me, a long time ago. This is my partner, Joanne Heller, and although we've been together and for 26 years, we were not together during the period of time I'm going to be talking to you about, which shows you how long ago it was. So, in 1980, probably 84, maybe 83, I was a resident at McMaster in a family practice resident. I already had my MD, and I went with some friends to see the some of the trial in Toronto for Dr. Henry Morgenthaler, and to observe it. And this would have been his second trial. Third trial. They were giving evidence at that time about the actual state of women's health because of this federal legislation, the detrimental effects of that legislation, because that laid the basis for his court cases was it was a violation of women's bodily autonomy. It was bad for us. And I was appalled as a physician, as a feminist. I was appalled. Let me just do a little backflash here. Oh, I really welcome your question and your comments, but I know if I get them in between my talking, I'll lose it. But please make notes, and I will leave a chunk of time at the end because I really, really welcome that. So I was already 35 years old. I had had several lifetimes before, as I think of it, before this, done different things. I was already a psychotherapist. I was a mother of a five, six-year-old, and I had lived kind of in and out of schooling and kind of hippie counterculture, and I was already a feminist. I had gone to I had volunteered at rape crisis centers and participated in consciousness raising groups where we used mirrors to look at our vulvas and our clitorises, don't leave them out. And I had worked as a volunteer in Montreal for a legal project that was looking at equal pay for equal work for women and the effects of ghettoization on women's work, and that was around the time of the Bell, Ma Bell court case, where there was a very big win that because of ghettoization for women in that industry, there was a huge financial award. We won, and there was a huge financial award, and it was good. Anyway. There weren't a whole lot of successes in that period, but there was a lot of anger, and there was a lot of, who do you think you are? It's me, it's my body, it's my life, and that was all around. That was just all around. So after I finished my residency, you imagine, I as a single parent and doing a residency, so I was a little bit busy. But when I finished, I moved to Toronto, and I got involved with the Ontario Coalition for Abortion Clinics. And I was kind of an envelope licker, and you know, I wasn't using my physician skills at all, but I was part of the movement. And one thing I really want to convey, oh, I don't know, there's so many different directions to go, but one thing I really want to convey is how important the movement itself was to the eventual success of the repeal of that abortion law. Henry Morgenthaler was an amazing, committed ally, no question about it, and he was the icebreaker that made many things possible. But just less than a decade before Henry started providing abortions in Montreal, another doctor in British Columbia did the same. And he did it kind of quietly. He had been providing, but mostly to students. He was right near UBC campus or something. I can't remember his name. I think it was Tom something. I met him, but he was jailed. His license was pulled, and he was jailed because there was no movement. He was a dedicated individual, and there was no coalition. There was no social movement behind him. And that it's that social movement that was required to defeat the abortion law. And the other thing I wanted to say is the abortion law itself was cobbled together at the request of physicians who were performing abortions. They were quietly doing abortions in hospitals, and there were always the opposition was always kind of at them a bit. Not anything like we know about or that you know about, but it was present. And they were worried. So they kind of petitioned the Liberal government to get an abortion law to protect them. And they threw in some concessions to the opposition to make it palatable enough so that it would pass. And it's, as you know, because you've been living without any law for so long, which is wonderful, there is a law. You can't practice medicine without a license. It's covered. There's no reason to single it out except for the reasons that it gets singled out, which all have to do with the control of women and the patriarchy, which you'll have to forgive me if I use old language, but it's the language I'm used to. At the time that Henry started, Henry was a family doctor with a small, happy little practice in a converted house in Montreal. And he was you probably know some of his story. I won't belabor it. He and his brother were survivors of concentration camps. Henry always had a sandwich in his pocket in case he was hot jailed. He was worried about being able to eat. You know, he had a legacy and a powerful amount of courage to do a lot of what he did. And he belonged to a humanist society, and which spoke out for a number of different items around women's emancipation, including the right to abortion. And so he was kind of known mostly locally as a doctor who supported this. He thought the law should be changed or repealed or whatever. And he spoke about that, and he spoke about other issues that the Humanist Society was involved in at the time, which I'm not that familiar with. And as a consequence, he got numerous requests from women for abortions. And the reason he got numerous requests is because by the time Henry was thinking about or struggling with whether or not to provide abortions, the situation with abortion access in this country was horrible. We had the highest mid-trimester abortion rate of all industrialized nations because the law delayed everything for so long that those women who could get them were delayed past 12 weeks, which nobody wants if there's an option. You know, sometimes it's necessary, but most times it's not. And the access was crazy. So you had a requirement that they only be performed in hospitals. So you couldn't have outpatient. You couldn't have clinics. It was only in hospital that it was legal. And there had to be an abortion, there had to be a therapeutic abortion committee that would approve this woman's abortion, each patient's abortion. So in some provinces, the committee just approved everyone. In some provinces, it approved the first six women, no matter what, and no one else got them that month, do you know? And then in other places, you had to be on the phone, on the phone, on the phone, and the phone was usually busy. And other provinces just weren't doing it at all. I mean, PEI said that they would take a physician's license away for them up until, I think it's probably 10 years ago, maybe even less than that. So PEI never had them. But anyway, there were provinces where there were none performed, and there were provinces where it was reasonable access, but lots of delays in any case. Oh, you had to have a letter from a psychiatrist. Ontario had that. You had to have a letter from. So there were delays then, delays getting, anyway, it was bad. It was bad. And women, the rate of attempts at self-termination were very high here. Deaths from bleeding and failed abortion because of women trying. I mean, you talk to any gynecologist of that period of time, which was a little bit before my time, and they had so many horror stories about women bleeding out in emergency rooms. The whole situation that law was supposed to liberalize or protect made it much, much worse. And those were the circumstances under which the criticisms of the law occurred. So Henry said, no, I'm not going to do it. And then a woman came, he said, no. And she used a vacuum cleaner to abort herself and died. And the next person who asked, he said yes. And he stood on his front steps and said, I am doing this. You know, he didn't do it like Tom, I think his name was, in British Columbia. This is a woman's right. I am doing this, blah, blah, blah. And he was arrested and charged. And I'm going to take too much of time on Henry, but it's an incredible story, really. But so is mine. Anyway. And anyway, he was arrested and charged. The jury acquitted him. I said he was a doctor doing his work to help his patients. So he went right back to doing it again. They didn't like that. They arrested him and charged him again. He spent some time in jail, which was very hard, as you can imagine, for a Holocaust survivor. And he had a heart attack in jail, which is not very good. And but they acquitted him again. And then the PQ was in power at that time. That's the Parti Québécois was in power in that time. And they just said, this law is unenforceable in this province. We are not going to charge any doctor any longer because this law is unenforceable. So within a month, the CLSAs, the community health clinics, all across the province, all except for maybe three of them, which had very Catholic support milieu, started providing abortions one day a week. It was just part of women's health care. You know, this is our area. Someone needs an abortion. They get the counseling, they get the whatever. They get the abortion. And it was wonderful. So the feminists in English Canada said, good, this is going to happen now. You know, this is going to happen. Do you say English Canada? We do. We did then. Okay. In English Canada, people just waited for a similar thing to happen. And it didn't. It didn't. And so the pro-choice movement decided that what was important to have was a clinic that would be the focus for attacking the law, and so that it would spread all across the country. And I just want to point out about OCAC. Ontario Coalition for Abortion Clinics was my kind of home-based organization. And I really believe that the leadership of that group, not myself, that's another thing. I wasn't really good at this. I mean, I was okay, and it was important. It was really important what I did, both as a doctor and as an activist. But I got to tell you, I was not really good at it. I didn't really have the speaking skills. I was more scared of that than doing the procedures. I didn't really have the surgical skills. I was kind of a touchy-feely doctor. I'd been a psychotherapist, for God's sake. I was not a surgeon, you know? And I eventually got very good, very safe provider of abortions, but I didn't start that way. And I wasn't politically savvy about this tactic is better than that tactic. I was more a follower and a learner in the environments I was in than I was a leader. But I was right next to the leaders, and man, was it exciting. Judy Rebick, Carolyn Egan, Linda Gardner, Bob Gardner, who I understand is there now, but they had government jobs, so they were never in the public, but they were the steering, part of the steering committee of the abortion of OCAC, and a group of wonderful, amazing leaders from the radical feminist community, most of whom were lesbian. This group was mostly lesbian-led, and from the anti-war movement, people came in. People came in and spent long periods of time within the steering committee. But those four people I mentioned were the core all the way from beginning to end. And it was, well, I'll wait till we open the clinic. Let me backtrack a little bit historically. So the first thing that this group did once they decided, oh, the question about the slogan of choice. There was a hotly contested debate about using choice. Because the concept of self-determination for your body was too radical for most of the general population. It was, what? You know, it was, it's commonplace now. I'd love to hear everybody talking about it, like that's what it is. But that's not how it was. And so this group of radical feminists who wanted the full emancipation of women, including self-determination of our bodies, decided to go with a slogan that was a liberal concept. Choice is a liberal concept. So you have the choice. Choice, you have choice to beat your partner? No, choice is like, it's out. But it worked because it embodied the sentiments of the population, which is people should have a choice. People should have a choice. It's, you don't want to have an abortion, great, don't have one. But let someone who needs one or wants one, nobody ever wants an abortion. No one gets pregnant to have an abortion, you know. But anyway, sorry, little aside there. But it worked. It was one of the most important things that the leadership did at that time. And it was not a done deal. It was a big argument. It was a really big argument. It was an argument right before I kind of came on board. But you could still hear it rumbling, you know? And what that enabled this group to do was to do what you call now intersectionality. It was coalition building. This group built the most, the strongest, widest coalition around repealing this law. North America, maybe Europe too, I don't know. But trade unions, religious groups, the Y, people who would come when the clinic was attacked. They drive from Etobicoke, you know? Like, it was such, and it didn't happen immediately. It happened with people going to meetings and talking to them, going to union, to the Women's Caucus and this union and telling them why they should get it to the floor and get something passed that the union would pass to support this. It was a lot of work. And OCAC met once a week on Tuesdays in the basement of a church in Toronto, and there were always 15 to 20 people. If you've known political groups, that's really unusual to have that kind of, that is really unusual to have that kind of consistency. And if something was happening, if Henry was in the news or was there was an attack or whatever, it was 30, you know? And this was every week. And it was the same group of people. We lost a bunch of activists to the AIDS struggle in the later, in the, you know, in like kind of 86 or so, they moved over. But then we got new people came in. So there was always this turnover, not so much in the steering committee, but like that. So they tried to get a local physician to open a clinic, and they really couldn't find someone. There were a number of, I didn't have my residency yet, but they were trying to find somebody. And there were a lot of people almost did it, but then they didn't want to lose their license. They were landed and they didn't want to be deported. There wasn't anybody who would do it. So they approached Henry and they asked him if he would come and set up a Toronto clinic, and he said no. He had finished his second trial. He was in a new relationship. He had a young child. He was in Montreal. His life was easy. Well, never easy, but his life was settled, and he didn't want to come to Toronto, right? So they kept trying. They kept trying, and eventually, they prevailed on him to come and start a clinic. And I think partially because Bob Scott, who was one of the other doctors who worked with Henry and was charged, arrested, and charged along with him in Toronto, agreed to work some of the time with him, so he wouldn't have it all on his own. And so the Toronto clinic opened, and he was arrested and charged. The two doctors were arrested and charged, and then released. And then he came back to the clinic, and there were 20,000 people outside. You know, they didn't arrest him again. They just let the clinic function while it went through the court. And it was kind of in there while he was commuting, and I was working as an activist, and I started to get, why don't you work at the clinic, you know, from some of the activists. And I had very mixed feelings about it. I had a young child. I was also a landed immigrant. I was born in the States, and I came here in the late 60s. Because I was opposed to the Vietnam War and to the backlash against some of the civil rights movement with the assassinations of Black Panthers, and I just had it. And I came very happily in 67, I think 66, 68, I don't know, okay, the end of 60s, and I was here. But I didn't want to get sent back either, so I applied for my citizenship, so I had a choice, and that took a little while, but not too long. And I thought about whether to do it. Would it make a difference, really? And I guess part of the issue was there were a lot of feminists, especially our radical feminists, and who supported Henry 100%, but were critical of him in some ways. And also that it was a disappointment that he was a man. They wanted a woman. He was a wonderful ally, but he didn't get it all, for sure. And they wanted a woman, they wanted a feminist, and they thought it would make a difference in terms of building the movement. So that's what persuaded me. If it could make a difference, I would do it. And so I did. And I went to Montreal and trained. So it was very small training. And I came back to Toronto. And I worked at the Toronto Clinic week on, week off for a couple of years. And it was hard. It had been arsoned twice. I wasn't arrested or charged initially. I was eventually, and I'll tell you that story, but they left me alone. Like, who's she anyway? It was very interesting. And when I went to speak with Henry, it was like, and then he'd speak, and then I would speak, and it was like, what is she, his girlfriend? Like, what is it? Like, the sexism was so, like, they didn't get it. They didn't get it at all. And even when we told them, they didn't get it. But the people for whom I was doing it got it, so that was okay. And there was constant in-your-face a line I had to cross to get into the clinic. And they would spray something from a little bottle in front of you and say, "Ha, I hope that kills you," you know. And it turned out to be nothing. Sometimes they followed me to, once they followed me to a restaurant. Usually I had somebody with me, but this time I was on my own. And they followed me into the restaurant. It was a tiny little place on Harvard Street, and I'm eating, and they're right, kind of right there shouting, "This woman's a baby killer!" You know, and I'm trying to eat my food. I have half hour, I have to go back and see patients. I finally stood up. In this, I don't know, maybe there were 30 people in the restaurant, maybe even less. And I said, "This woman is really harassing me. I work at the Morgenthaler Clinic down the street. Can anybody help me?" Everybody stood up. So like 10 people stood up, put themselves between me and her, escorted her out. I just felt like protected in such an important way. It's like, it was like riding the crest of a movement, you know? It was really like riding the crest. They picketed my son's birthday party. I was talking to a friend as we walked down the street, and I guess one of them overheard me. And he'll never, I mean, my son is now 45, but he wanted me to all tell you that it was scary. Those years were scary, you know? Death threats. Bomb on the bus, you know, that I commuted to Kitchener to provide abortions for. It was just a scare, and there was no bomb. But when you hand on your visa in a store and they call out your name, I was so afraid. I put all my visas in my friend's name, so that if they called the name out, it wouldn't be my name. I had a little cabin in. Out of town, and I put it in my friend's name, so I couldn't be found that way. I still have PTSD from that time. Honestly, I wouldn't say it's a lot right now, but still, if somebody calls my name, look, I picked this. Where do I want my back to the wall? You know, I just there's a lot about me that has to do with just kind of soldiering on, and I didn't process it at the time. I was just toughy. I was just, you know, I was a toughy, or I tried to be a toughy, which reminds me about the marshals from the movement. Like whenever we had our demos, we marshaled our own demonstrations and our own rallies, and there were mostly lesbian women marshaling the crowds. It was wonderful. We felt so powerful in the street. And the cops were there, and you know what? The cops were kind of on our side. They would apologize, most of them. It was not the same dynamic that you get with some of the other social movements that I've been in, where there was more opposition. So the other thing I did is I became one of the national spokespersons for the movement, and I did media, and I traveled across the country. Thank you. I traveled across the country talking about why the law should be repealed and the situation with women and how bad it was. And at the same time I did that, I met with the local activists, because everybody was thinking about, can we open a clinic? You know, can we? First of all, women needed it. You know, the delays were still horrible. And second of all, it was another political focus if it could happen. So I was able to foster a clinic in Kitchener and one in Peterborough. We met with the CLSC docs who were comfortably providing their abortions once a week to learn from them, right? Because we would go annually to abortion medical, continuing education kind of medical things, and we'd run into all these people, because it wasn't just the docs, it was all the staff that would go to those things, counselors and nurses and front door people. And once when I was talking in Edmonton, Edmonton had a very strident anti-choice presence. And a number of them came to the meeting. And we had organized the meeting. We knew we were there. And it was a tactic of the movement not to face off. When they had a demo, we did not counter-demo. If they counter-demoed us, we ignored them. It was right, wrong. It worked for us. The press, all you'd see is the argument. They'd never show your position or what was happening or the problems because they're so busy showing the fight. So we just didn't do that. So in this meeting, we took written questions instead of letting anybody stand up and ask questions because we knew they were there. And they submitted questions. Carolyn Egan was with me. She's going through them. We answered some of theirs. It was pretty clear it was theirs. And we answered some of theirs. There's a dialogue to be had if you can have a dialogue with somebody. I mean, there's issues, right? then the meeting ended. And they were really angry because they hadn't gotten a chance to stand up and yell at us or yell their thing, whether it's us or not. So they rushed the stage. And it looked like it was going to be fisticuffs and I was going to be the cuff. So the wonderful marshals who had purple ribbons on, I had kept that purple ribbon, I still have it, kind of came right down the front aisle and scooted me out the back, and that was that. Needless to say, we didn't open a clinic in Edmonton, but that was like, all those events, they stay. And the courage of the women, just the courage of the marshals and of the quick-thinking people who could retort to the press. They want to do a citizen's arrest? Well, I'm going to arrest you, Judy Rivick says, you know? Like, quick thinking. I couldn't think quick. The day after, I might have thought of something like that, but not right then. And it was an amazing time. Hamilton, I also talked to them. Because Hamilton almost came to happen, because McMaster had a bunch of people who were interested, and I was speaking to them and about how they could do it. I always said to them, you get it organized, I'll find you a doctor. I didn't know that doctor would usually be me. I was really hoping it wouldn't be, but it turned out that way a few times. But anyway, and apparently Ontario government was not happy with the idea of another clinic. They had this one set of charges. It was working its way up to the Supreme Court, the charge with Henry when he came to Toronto to open the clinic with Bob Scott. And they were unhappy about that, so they arrested me. They arrested Henry and Bob and me again. And we found out about it, we knew it was coming. I packed Holly Near cassette. I don't know if that means anything to anybody, but anyway, Holly Near cassette. You can put it in your music. It's Take Back the Night or something. Anyway, it was a good tape cassette. My knitting. I never had to stay overnight, but that's what was in my bag. And they took us down and they charged us, and then they released us with a stay pending the Supreme Court decision on the first case, the first Toronto case. So I just went back to the clinic and continued to work, just like Henry had. And we continued working at the clinic until the law was repealed, 88. 88, the law was repealed. It was really amazing. And then maybe 3 to 6 months later, the Ontario government decided to allow abortion to be in OHIP so that women no longer had to pay. That was almost as big. That was almost as big. It was good. Questions? Yeah, comments as well as questions. Yes.
I just wanted to ask, you said you volunteered at like the rape center. I was wondering if survivors were taken seriously or if there were rape kits or like what was the police doing to try to catch individuals who committed those crimes?
Not much. No. Yeah, no. Well, this was 72, 73. And there were rape kits, but they weren't everywhere they needed to be. And it was mostly peer support. There was nothing built into the system at all. nothing built into the system. There was a lot of counseling for, it created a women's center. So survivors could come back, you know, and for however long they needed to have counseling or just to hang out, honestly, right? So it was a really women-centered space. But there was not a lot of police. They did some training with police. There were some of the police that, whatever they're called, precincts or whatever, who were open to training. So that was one of the focuses. But it was the very beginning of that in that city. So, yeah, it was important to me, and I know important to them. It made me so angry.
I have like 45,000 questions.
I bet.
So I'm an abortion doula here in Ottawa.
Wonderful.
I'm a professor in women's and gender studies. And
yeah.
Research on clandestine abortion in Latin America. So first of all, I'm so thrilled that you're here and that you're all getting to hear this history. It is so important, and I'm glad you're recording it. Like, I'm really just absolutely thrilled. And so the first of my 45,000 questions is, I'm just wondering, like, it's so interesting to hear you talk about that period of time and what it must have meant when everything changed. And then I wonder, now as you see, like, Roe v. Wade in the U.S., but also, like, in a more positive way, like, the Green Wave in Latin America, like, all of these countries are decriminalizing abortion. Like,
yes.
There's this kind of dual moment, right? Where, like,
horrible
yes. things in the U.S., amazing things in other places. And just, like, looking back on the experience you've had, I just wonder if you, what you think, thinking back on your, I guess it's not a question. Anyway, I'm just interested in hearing you think about, like, your that history that you just told us in relation to the kind of present moment, which is quite broad.
Yes. I don't know.
Yeah.
Honestly. Fair. No, but no, I'll say the teeny bit. But, first of all, one of my recovery and healing things, I'm 75, is that I'm not involved.
Mm.
I mean, you can't not involved, but I'm right.
Yeah.
But it seems to me we're really in turmoil. You know, really in turmoil. To see the surge in the United States in response to losing Roe v. Wade is wonderful. And it's based on, it's my body, you can't do this, which is like so much further than choice. So I take heart in that. I live in a good state, so that makes a difference for me personally. There's a lot of underground stuff going on, getting abortions to women in states that don't have coverage, and that's good. And I don't know. Yes.
Hi. I wrote down a fairly lengthy question, which sort of has to do with exactly what you asked. To avoid you having to go over that again, I'll just ask the last part of my question, which is, considering the recent elections that have happened in several different U.S. states where voters did turn out and help to oppose the overturning of Roe v. Wade, do you find a sense of confidence or security in that movement? And do you see that, do you see the public in America pushing back enough over the next, say, 10 years to pressure the, I mean, it's hard to say because I know the Supreme Court isn't something that really, like, the people can force their hand, but
yes.
Do you think that
quite the opposite, yeah.
Yeah, but do you think that, like, people's movements will be enough to keep the laws in check?
I think we're at a tipping point, really.
Mm-hmm.
I'm vastly encouraged by the responses, men, women, just across the board, about you're doing what, you know? But there's a very powerful a fascist movement in the United States, and winning an election means they're not only the movement coming to vote, but the steps of voting not be undermined so that the vote is real. Do you know, there's a lot of moving parts here. And I think it will be okay, but I think we're at a tipping point. And if it tips the other way, I think it'll be quite a while before things shift. I might be back here.
So you mentioned previously intersectionality when it came to implement itself. And obviously you mentioned that your practice was affected by it. So I was curious as to the medical community and how you were, their reaction to the clinic at the time, and if you felt like they were supportive of the cause or if they were, like, I'm curious as to how.
That's such a good question. No, I was on the outside. I mean, as a woman in those years, as a woman physician in those years, I was on the outside anyway. But I was on the outside. But lots of the gynecologists who were really tired of having women die in their arms, you know, were very admiring of Henry and of the Toronto Clinic, but most would not. Cross the line. I did ask before I started. I was at some medical thing, and I asked. Oh, it was a fundraising thing for the clinic, and I asked a Toronto gynecologist if I could refer cases to him if I had a complication, because that's really a problem. You can't do a surgical procedure and not a case. Abortion is very safe. It's safer than childbirth, but anything you do sometimes has complications, and. So I asked him if I could refer patients to him, because a lot of times you couldn't. No one would take it. And it's worse now. Now we're in the States, we're in this horrible position. But anyway, women dying because they come with a miscarriage, and somebody's so worried that they're going to get charged that they won't see them for the miscarriage, and they bleed out. You know, this is happening. But they were watching from afar. Many of them were supportive to the change in the law and to the clinic, but they were watching from afar. Yeah. There was another part to your question. What was it? Did I miss it?
Sorry.
Did I get it?
I was wondering if there was a contemporary.
Oh, for the, yeah, for the, but I know what it was. You reminded me of something important that I wanted to say, is that the policy positions for OCC and for the pro-choice movement at this time were this list here. It wasn't just an abortion rights movement. We were against forced sterilization, which was happening. You know, we knew doctors who were doing it, poor women, indigenous women, and no consents a lot of times. You know, you go in to have a baby, you come out, and oh, by the way, your tubes have been tied because you have two others, or because you're poor, or the wrong color of skin, or whatever. You know, the wrong social group. It was terrible. And we were for the right for indigenous women to keep their children, and for equal pay for equal work, and for daycare and prenatal and economic, you know, just, it was, they picked the opposition who want control of women. You know, the one to be able to say, that kid you birthed is mine. Not someone else's, right? They're the ones who picked abortion as an issue. We didn't pick abortion. We'll defend it if you pick it. But it isn't the thing we would pick out of the hat to defend women's emancipation, you know? I would pick economic if you had me, right? But they don't, I mean, and not that that's not worth fighting for. It isn't, but it is. But anyway, I made my point. Yeah.
I wanted to ask what it was like to learn to perform abortions, like in a time where like the legality was precarious and like few people willing to teach you.
It was hairy. Also, it was hairy because I wasn't like a surgical person, you know. So, I went to Montreal the night before. I took kitchen implements. I had read about what the steps were, right? And I put out I was afraid I was going to forget the steps. Right? So I put out the kitchen implements, and I said, okay, first you do that, then you do that. And I would do it over the night before, over and over. And then I went in, and I found out Henry's clinic had a nurse who handed you to them. I mean, it's probably good I did it. But the other thing is that it's a very straightforward mechanical. It's not hard to learn. It isn't really. I mean, I was more frightened of putting needles into cervixes, I felt like I should light a candle every time, you know? Something. Not frightened, but it was hard, right? Then of the abortion itself, yeah.
I wanted to know, because I'm most interested in the education around abortions and birth control and all of that. How was the, because nowadays, I feel like with pregnancy crisis centers and things where they're misinforming women about the risks against abortions and maybe trying to postpone abortions until it's too late.
Yes, that's, they're still doing that?
Yeah.
Oh.
So how is the education around those subjects countering those sorts of pro-life movements, even though they're like, it's a choice, and you have the choice to have an abortion or not. Was the information around it clear and concise, and how was the proper information spread at that time?
With difficulty, right? You're lucky here with universal health care, at least, that most people have access to primary care. We don't have that in the States. We have it in some states, but in general, we don't have it. But the movement generated reams of wonderful information. The Immigrant Women's Health Center did, in many languages, you know, generated wonderful information about contraception, about the risks of abortion and the safety of abortion, about the actual facts about fetal development versus the pictures that the anti-choice movement would put out they used pictures of a 5-month fetal demise as if it were what happens in a first trimester abortion. So facts, all of that was available, and some of it generated by the movement itself. But then the question you raise is, how does it get into the right hands? And that's always a struggle. It's always a struggle to get it there. The more, the better. Yeah. Do you have anything? Like, any comment about that?
Because I don't know. There's the reason why I found out about pregnancy crisis centers.
Yes.
Is through sort of mainstream media now. Last week tonight with John Oliver.
Oh.
And he was talking about it in terms of it's widespread now that people
really
are trying to misinform women.
Yeah.
And he made a whole segment about it.
Yes.
But it's that conversation, I feel like, still hasn't been fully shown to everyone.
Yes.
I feel like it should be wider spread of
yes,
the conversation.
Absolutely. You go for it, girl. It's important. Yeah,
yeah,
it really is.
I'm very glad and I'm grateful for what you're doing and making it open, and like I believe in the choice for women.
Yes.
Because there's so many circumstances, right, that puts a woman in that position.
Yes, and it's hard. It's also very hard for women to know. I've seen so many women said as abortion patients, who've told me, I never thought I would do this, but it's the right thing to do. Do you know? It's sometimes really hard to know what you would do. And for some women, it's easy. It's clear they're they have a 3-month at home, old at home, or whatever. They know they just started school. It's very clear to them. And for other women, it's a very difficult decision. And then for most women, it's somewhere in the middle. But there are lots of different reasons. But it is hard to know. I think the important thing is, I might not want it, but I won't stand in the way of someone else who thinks it's the right thing.
I was wondering, since obviously it wasn't under like OHIP, but was there any kind of financial support?
No.
And how much would it cost for these women to try and get an abortion?
Well, back So a group of people who worked at the Morgan Tyler Clinic after 88 and I left to found a new clinic in Toronto, Joyce and Health Clinic, and we did it as a feminist clinic, you know, so it was all women-centered and it was wonderful. But what was your question?
How much it would cost for a woman to try and get
so at that time, it was $300. That's a lot of money. So there were always kind of pro-choice money around. So we could get funds for people who needed it. We never turned anyone away for an ability to pay, and neither did Henry. Before 88, before the law, just one example of many that comes to mind, a woman, a 17-year-old and her mother arrive at the clinic. They have driven from Newfoundland, slept in their car, right, to have an abortion for this young woman.
I just wanted to add a quick comment. I just put $300 in the inflation.
Oh, good. Tell us.
I did it for the year 1985.
Good.
I don't know what specific year.
Good.
But that would be the equivalent of $750.
Oh, yeah. It was a huge barrier. Huge.
I was wondering, so lots of the clandestine abortions that happen now are using misoprostol, right? There's
yes.
So medical abortion, much easier. I mean,
yes.
Still illegal in many places, but much easier to like slip somebody's
exactly
than be a doctor actually.
Absolutely.
I'm so curious how, and again, I don't know if you know how, like, how were you so brave? Like, did you have a plan for like, I'm going to go up to this point and then after that I'm out? Like, how? I'm quite stunned by what you did.
I had grandparents who were communists in Ukraine in the turn of the century. Uh-huh. Skipped a generation. My parents were very much liberals.
Yeah.
You know, progressive, but liberals. And being oppositional, being a rebel and standing up was a little bit of my DNA all the way along. So that was part of it. I did not like the threat of violence. That did really scare me. When I was doing my pre-med courses at McGill, I went to go to a lab and I had sandals on, my hippie self still. I had sandals on. And there was a rule, you can't go into the lab if you have sandals on. It's a good rule, because if you spill a chemical, that's not a good thing. And this middle-aged white man told me I couldn't come, and I really needed this lab to get in for, I don't know why I thought I really needed it, but I really thought I needed it. These were my pre-med courses that were going to make the difference about whether I would go to med school or not. And he stood in the door, and I can't tell you the rage I had. Like, I could have just barreled him over with the rage from the Rape Crisis Center, this was before my involvement with the choice movement, but it was, you are not gonna take my body, you know, you are not blocking me. And luckily I had a friend in the class, a guy actually, who came over and said, Nikki, you don't wanna do that, and then I didn't, you know. But I have that rage. This is my body, you know, and I felt that way. I feel that way when they separate children from their families, the immigrants, and when they separate, you know, when they won't let someone come in who needs to be here, you know, it's just like, I have it. I don't know. I don't have it anymore. I can feel it now. This is bad. I've kind of, you know.
That's good.
That's good, right? That's good. And also, I had a partner at the time who was a white South African who had come to North America in the 70s to New York City. And I went with him to Cape Town while apartheid was still happening. And I met some doctors there. I need to stop soon.
Do we have till 25?
Okay.
Yeah.
We met some doctors there who had practiced civil disobedience and not joined the draft, and who were gay activists, and who had clinics in the townships, and the townships were just structures set up by people, towns that are established by people who weren't supposed to be living there, but they work there, and they can't live on the land that had been given to them to live on, and they live there. And they set up water distribution, they set up taxis that go to town to get groceries and where you get them when you come back. The whole thing was set up by them, for them. And from time to time, the government would come and bulldoze it, right? And still, you had kids, and it was patrolled by these tanks. Like when we drove in, this doctor gave us a tour, and they know him because he ran the medical clinic there. And when we drove in, the tank follows us in. It is scary looking tank, I'm sorry. And follows him in, and he just drives into his thing, and the kids pick up stones and throw them, right? And he showed me the rickets because they just don't get enough vitamin D and all of the preventable stuff that, whatever. And he introduced us to some of the people he knew, and they were so friendly. They were so, like, I couldn't believe it. Do you know, like, I was a white person from a rich country coming to see his township, their township, and they were so, well, I was a friend of Tom's, I know, so, oh, maybe it isn't Tom there. I know it's Tom there. Oh, well, anyway. they were curious. They were really happy to see someone who was interested. And I have to tell you, when I got scared in Toronto, I would think of them. I would just think of them, you know. And shortly after we left, they bulldozed it again, you know. And I would just think, you know, I'm privileged. I'll be okay unless they, you know, I didn't like the period when they're shooting doctors. Like they're every November for a while, one of us got shot. Abortion providers. I don't know if you know that. I don't know why they picked November. It was November 9th, and some were injured, some were killed, some were like I did not like that. Many of us didn't work that week. You know, I didn't work that week. But mostly going in and doing the job, it was all about taking care of people. Do you know, like being a doula, it's just all taking care of people, really. That's the focus. Yeah. Yeah.
My question is, like, when you would go travel to places other than Toronto to kind of train people in opening these clinics.
Yes.
Aside from training people, like, how to give safe abortions, what was involved in the training for opening, like, a civilly disobedient abortion clinic?
So, I never got to the point of doing the actual physical training for the procedure itself at these places. They were too far along. So mostly it was more mentoring and encouraging than it was training. It was identify your group, you know, find out which docs might be willing to make referrals or not. Just like I had a kind of a list of things about setting themselves up. Make coalitions before you do anything. Find the why, find the church, find the whatever. You know, it was more political than medical. Make yourself a hive. Make yourself a hive. And if you have the oomph, if there is the hive that will support a clinic, I'll find you a doctor. That's what I would say, because they would say, no one will do it, no one will do it. So I tried to take that piece out. I was never exactly sure how I would find someone. But I knew I would, because there are doctors all over the country who were wanting to help, right? So it was less like training and more like political propagandizing.
Strategizing.
Building, yeah. Yes, and mentoring, so they could call. And they did often. They would call me or write to me. I didn't do email because I didn't know how in those times, but they would talk about, they tried this and blah, 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 and they would talk to me, and then I would call Carolyn or somebody and say, what do I tell them? Yeah?
I don't know. I'm like, I entered the very male-dominated world of video gaming a lot, because I think it's fun. So it's kind of a scary sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
Just the vitriol I've heard, just because of the way my voice sounds. But I don't know, like, I encounter, maybe I'm looking in all the wrong places, but I encounter all of, like, the worst of stuff. And
I'm sorry to hear that.
I find, like, what did you do to, like, cope? Or even, like, did you have something you told yourself when you were working, when you encountered that, you know? Even if it was just, like, as simple, not even simple, but as, like, just your teacher there telling you you're not allowed in the lab. Like, did you have something you told yourself to kind of give yourself power again?
Yeah.
Or just continue to have the willpower?
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of a single sentence.
Yeah.
A single sentence. But the sentence changes. Mm-hmm. But something that I don't remember my sentences, but sometimes it's an image instead of a sentence. Like the township in Cape Town was an image, one of those kids throwing a rock. But sometimes it was just, I don't know, almost like, picturing one of the marshals at the demo, you know, who would hold back the cops and the traffic and the whatever, because we were coming through, you know, something strong. And sometimes it's just a physical stance. If you can find a body stance, and you don't even have to do it, doing it helps, but picturing yourself in that stance, powerful, helps sometimes, letting the stuff just go. I don't know if that helps, but all of those things. But sometimes a single sentence, you may go along and find a sentence out of context that say, oh, I might be able to use that.
Yeah.
So this is not about me.
Yeah.
This is not about me. That's a good one.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I wanted to say just one more thing about being a lesbian. That was on your list of questions. I didn't want to leave it off. I identify as a lesbian, obviously, my partner of many years. But when I was doing the pro-choice work, I did not. I knew in my kind of middle 20s that my primary attachment and feelings were with women. A very good friend of mine from childhood came to visit and came out to me, and then I was like, you know, all of a sudden I had feelings I had names for. So that's really different. I mean, growing up now in high school, you can name things because it's out, I think. I mean, not always. You can't make generalizations. But it was I graduated high school in 65. And I saw lesbian and gay people. I was in New York City, and my parents were involved in community theater, and there were gay and lesbians in the theater, that they were their friends, and I saw them, but it didn't touch my feelings, so I didn't know. And when Annie came out to me, and I did know, I could kind of look back at my life in high school and junior high and say, oh, that was a crush. You know, I understood in a different way. But I wanted very much to be a mom, and I didn't think that I could be a mom as a lesbian couple. Now, 10 years later, every lesbian I knew had kids, so my timing was bad. I did have a male partner who was wonderful during the years of my activism, who helped with parenting and support, and is a kindergarten teacher. He was a lovely man. That was the South African, by the way. Yeah, lovely man. But I mean, it was like, Joanna says, like shopping in the wrong closet, you know? And I really thought it was a choice. I thought I could make a choice about whether or not to be a lesbian. I didn't understand. It wasn't about choosing a lifestyle. It was about not being myself. And it really wasn't until I had relationships and chose a relationship that I understood that all of those years I thought I was choosing somehow, I wasn't myself, and it damped not only that part of me, but it damped a lot of other things because I was so busy kind of performing or something, and I didn't even know that. And I was just wrong about it being a choice. It's kind of who I am. And I was so glad to find that out. Yeah, so I wish I had been out during that time. It was pretty hard being around all those really cool lesbians, right? But, yep, so that was my story.
Kaladni, truly that was incredibly special for me, and I'm sure everyone else too.
Yeah.
If anyone had questions for Dr. Kaladni that they didn't get a chance to ask, feel free to write it down and submit it to me.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. And thank you. It was so wonderful being here with you all, just knowing you all exist with your thoughts and your questions and your it's heartening. Do you know, it's just very heartening, because especially from the land we're living in right now, it's not very heartening a lot of the time. So this is very good. We don't have contact with this very much. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me.